This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. There are more than 300,000 victims of human trafficking in Texas. That includes almost 79,000 minors and youth victims of sex trafficking. That's according to a groundbreaking study by the Institute on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault at the UT Austin School of Social Work. Human trafficking happens when a person is controlled through violence or coercion into situations of commercial sex, forced labor, or domestic servitude. The scope of the crime is difficult to measure, but it's clear that Texas is a hotbed for human trafficking. The research and investigations are underway to find out why that is, where the problem is rooted, and how can the victims be identified, freed, and then given the social help that they need to recover. We're joined by Melissa Torres, the director of the Human Trafficking Research at the University of Texas at Austin's Institute on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Bruce Kellison, he is the director of the Bureau of Business Research at UT Austin's IC Squared Institute, and Dana Franks. She is the Deputy Director of Programs at the San Antonio Rape Crisis Center. And our phone lines are open if you want to call in with your questions or comments. The number is 210-614-8980. If you have been touched by a human trafficking, either yourself or someone in your family, in your life, we would love to hear your stories. It would be great to share those stories and let people know what it is that we're talking about, how it impacts people. 210-614-8980. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org. Melissa Torres, thank you so much for joining us. And tell us about your study looking at human trafficking here in Texas.
Thanks for having us. So this report is the culmination of a two-year study that started with the Institute on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault and a collaboration with the governor's office here in Texas when they needed a little bit more information regarding prevalence and the numbers on human trafficking here in the state for a lot of reasons, for the response approach, the community services, and also for policy. And so the team got together and said we could do that study. We could look into the prevalence, assess the rates that it's happening here within the state, assess the economic impact, and give a little bit of a better idea of what we're up against here in the state of Texas.
How do you go about trying to measure something that is in the shadows?
It's an illicit activity, so the populations are vulnerable and hidden. Anytime you're doing research with vulnerable and hidden populations, a lot of the times the numbers that you see have to be taken with a grain of salt. You have to look at where does that data come from, who is really profiling, and overall, what definition of human trafficking are they using? We wanted to get a more holistic approach. We looked at both sex and labor trafficking and started looking at different data sets from different types of law enforcement, community response groups, organizations that work in any kind of trafficking or in with any of the factors that might lead to trafficking, and started looking at cases, prevalence rates within their organizations or within their caseloads, and then started weeding out from there what we actually saw in terms of exploitation and trafficking risks.
Bruce Kellison, tell me about IC Squared Institute and what is the vision, the view from there about human trafficking?
The fact that we were asked to participate on the study was very flattering to us. IC Squared studies entrepreneurial networks, and one of the things the Bureau of Business Research within the Institute does is study economic impact. And so the bulk of our work on the project was not only trying to evaluate the economic impact, but perhaps in phase two, we can start to do something about the entrepreneurial networks behind trafficking. We're very interested in disrupting those, of course, and not building them, which is what we do in most of our work, building entrepreneurial networks, but disrupting them in this instance. The work in this report represents a significant effort to try to put economic impact numbers around the effect of trafficking on the state's economy, on specific economic sectors, but also what's going to take for society to address the the long-term impacts on victims.
So you talk about entrepreneurial networks, and so that we need to get into that and figure out what that means. I mean, are you saying that so that this is not just a one guy finding runaways and exploiting them, or there is an international group of individuals who are finding women in one part of the world and bringing to another to be exploited?
All of the above. I think the what we see in the trafficking world, both on the labor side and the sex trafficking side, is small-time operators, but also very elaborate entrepreneurial networks of traffickers and perpetrators who work together to facilitate cross-border transport of victims, launder money, in many of the same ways that drug trafficking and weapons trafficking occurs. Much of this work is going to happen in phase two. The important work we did in phase one was to look at the economic impact on victims.
And there is an internet component as well. We know about the dark web, where the contact with the customers are, I guess, happens. And do you look at that?
Not so dark, actually. It unfortunately, it happens on sites like Backpage and even on Facebook. It's a societal problem that we all have to be more aware of. Victims are hidden, and it's a difficult crime to confront, but it's so often right in front of our noses. We need to learn how to identify victims and disrupt these networks as best we can.
And Deanna Franks over at the Rape Crisis Center in San Antonio, real quickly, what are you seeing there? I mean, do you get calls from people asking, I want to get out?
Occasionally we get calls that they're identifying that they've been trafficked, but usually we go to the hospital for someone who's been assaulted, and then during conversation we find out this isn't a one-time thing, and then that's when we can trace it back to help identify them as being trafficked.
Okay, and so, but you're working, trying to free people from the situation, or you're working with law enforcement, you're trying to bring social services to those who have been freed. I mean, there's a lot going on, I bet.
Right, yes. Law enforcement's the one who handles the legal part of it, and the, you know, going in and rescuing them as per se. We don't do that at the Rape Crisis Center. If someone calls us, we get their information, we give it to law enforcement so they can do that part. We don't want to endanger ourselves or the survivor. That's their job. We handle the victim services and the follow-up care.
All right, so we are talking about human trafficking across Texas. We know that Texas is a hotbed for human trafficking. We've seen that the numbers bear that out, that a third, almost a third of all the calls to the human trafficking website, to the of hotline, comes from Texas, as showing to be a sign that this is where the tip of the spear should be trying to figure out what we can do about it to rescue people who have been trafficked, and also and somehow prosecute the people who are behind it. Our phone lines are open if you want to call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980, and we'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about human trafficking. And people think of that as forced prostitution, but there's also forced labor and domestic servitude. There's many ways that this impacts the economy and life here in Texas. And we're talking about this afternoon. If you want to call in, the number is 210-614-8980. Deanna has called in. And Deanna, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Okay. So mine is somewhat a question and a comment. I believe that the root source needs to be addressed, and the root source is that our laws are antiquated, unrealistic, and impractical, because human trafficking is always a larger issue in countries and places where prostitution is illegal, and it's not being monitored, and it's not being regulated. So if you want to end the prostitution side and the underage prostitution side of the human trafficking, then the first thing you need to do is you need to legalize, regulate, monitor, and tax prostitution, because you're never going to get rid of the sex industry in any country, even if it's operating on a covert basis, because there are a few things that human beings are going to do. And having sex and these kind of behaviors internationally will always occur. I've lived internationally. I've been in countries where this is legalized and monitored, such as Germany, and they have a much better outcome. They have less issues. They're going to have less disease spread. You're going to have less victims. You're going to put the hands, the control back in the hands of certain females who decide to do this as a profession and decide to work for a brothel, which is being regulated, such as in Nevada. Instead of having just a few criminal gangs get together and traffic underage women across the border.
All right, Diana, thank you for your call. We appreciate you with that point of view. Let me ask you, Melissa Torres, does she have a point?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of valid points that she addresses. If possible, I'd like to take it a step further. I agree that human trafficking is a huge issue where prostitution is a large market. But the majority, and as also seen in our study, the majority of human trafficking that happens worldwide is actually labor trafficking. And we often forget about those victims and those risks. I agree that prostitution, the legalization or decriminalization of it, is an issue, and there's a lot of factors that play into that. But I don't think the answer necessarily is decriminalization if we're talking about root problems. Root problems is actually poverty. It's actually human rights and access to health care and these kinds of issues where certain populations and certain majority women and trans women aren't left with many other options than sex work. There are several women who do have more resources and choose to do it. But if we want to really talk about root causes, we have to talk about a lot of societal factors that play into that, because this is an issue where the victims are vulnerable to a lot of issues. The exploitation happens because they're vulnerable to other factors. In a lot of countries, and I've worked in a few in Latin America, where prostitution is decriminalized, that doesn't necessarily end human trafficking, but it does make it easier to separate and not conflate from prostitution. Someone working in prostitution willingly is not a trafficking victim. There may be other factors in that where we can talk about coercion and other risks that are at play. But we do need to separate the situation where someone is in forced prostitution, which then becomes trafficking.
So just because if you end the illegality of prostitution doesn't mean that you end forced prostitution. Is that what you're saying?
Right. It is easier to monitor and not have that conflation that we've seen a lot with different law enforcement responses. But it doesn't necessarily end wherever there's a vulnerability, because the prostitution itself isn't the issue. It's the factors that tie into prostitution and forced prostitution. So human trafficking will remain regardless. It might lessen, but it will still remain.
Okay. And let's go to Art. On Art, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Okay. I'm Art. Been involved somewhat with this terrible thing over the last 6 or 7 months on a pro bono basis, and I've been doing a lot of reading, and I don't see anything coming out right now on going after really more. And I heard about some of the root problems with poverty and race, etc. That it turns out, from what I'm understanding, is about a third white, third Mexican American, third black, and there is some pieces in there, but the root, what are people doing about going after the Johns and the pimps and starting to put some pressure on what can be done over social media, which is, from my understanding, enabling a lot of the increase. I had heard 6 months ago, which was awful, that there were 7,000 of these domestic minors engaged in sex trafficking. Now it's 79,000. Which is more than a little different. So anyway, I'll take answers off the air.
All right. Thank you for that, Art. Let me turn to you, Bruce Callison, over at the IC Squared Institute, since you are looking at technology and the online component that he raises. So there are certain keywords that come up online in descriptions of some services that sort of can tip off law enforcement on whether or not someone is being trafficked or not. You know, words that may talk about the person who's providing these services. Is that something that y'all look at? You could create algorithms that to look for these things?
I think law enforcement is aware of the role that social media plays in facilitating human trafficking. And we can report from our work with the Austin Police Department's human trafficking unit that they are doing this. They are monitoring websites. The problem is that traffickers are always one or two or three steps ahead of law enforcement. And it turns into a whack-a-mole situation where law enforcement has difficulty keeping up with the innovations and the skills that traffickers are showing in the sex trafficking sector. So while there is a technological component to the problem, I think it comes down to the resources and the effectiveness that law enforcement has at its disposal to address the problem. And without more resources, local law enforcement and DPS at the state level don't have the capacity to address the problem in its current form.
Melissa Torres, what about the Johns? Are they being held accountable?
I think there's actually a lot of focus on the Johns. Whenever you talk about human trafficking, people tend to focus on sex trafficking. And when you focus on sex trafficking, a lot of people tend to focus on minors. And then the topic of the Johns comes up. As important as it is to address that situation and the possible risks that are out there through men that are soliciting sex, the traffickers need to remain the focus. Whoever is forcing people into these situations are the traffickers. Meeting other factors is helpful, but we can't shift that focus from the people who are actually forcing victims into situations unwillingly.
Being labeled a sex offender in our society and having to register as one is that's a pretty onerous thing to have happen to you. Do Johns have to do that, Melissa?
There are different policies that have been on the floor of registering as sex offenders, and it varies from state to state. Here in the state of Texas, currently, I don't believe that they have to, but it has been a legislative bill that has been proposed. I could be wrong on that if a caller would like to correct that or if Dina has any information on that. But one of the larger issues as well is in protecting the minor victims who might have to have some kind of criminal record in prostitution and getting that expunged. Those have also been bills that have been brought up to protect the minor victims as well from facing that kind of repercussions.
So Dina Franks from the San Antonio Rape Crisis Center, what do you see happening with Johns?
As far as I know, I agree with Melissa. I don't think there is anything in place to have them register as a sex offender. And since we deal with the victim side of it, I really can't speak too much about the Johns situation.
Okay, but back to the victim's side of it. Tell me about what it is that you do see. I mean, you do come into contact with the victims and you hear their stories, and what do they tell you?
Most of the time, because we respond to the hospital for anyone who's been sexually assaulted in the city of San Antonio. So the most recent one that I can remember is whenever I went to present at the hospital with a survivor and we were sitting there talking to her and she's a minor. We really talk about the situation that just happened. Why are they there right now? Because you have 96 hours to report a sexual assault. We've now started expanding that discussion a little farther outside of that window to see what's really going on. And when she was asked a question that's asked about sex partners and when was the last time you had consensual sex, she had a very long list of partners. And so that kind of got us to thinking a little bit more and kind of let's look into this a little bit more. She considered those consensual sex acts when actually she was being trafficked. And so her having multiple partners over a very short period of time was a flag for us to have more conversation. And she was actually being trafficked by her boyfriend.
Did she know she was being trafficked?
No, she didn't call it that. She just said, well, you know, I love him. We need to pay for bills. He's trying to find a job. He doesn't have one. This is the way that I can make sure we pay for what we need. So she didn't identify as a victim.
Is that typical? Is that uncommon?
No, it's typical for what we're seeing. It's very typical. The reason she came in, she had injuries from a sexual act that she had performed with someone for pay, and she came because she had injuries and he was worried about her. So that's why she came in. And so we were addressing that one incident and ended up being a lot more than just that one time.
So is should there be more outreach and educate young women about what it is to be trafficked, and so that they will recognize that, hey, this is not the situation I want to be in. I mean, how do we do that?
We really try to focus on the community as a whole, because we really don't want to just focus on the young girls and tell them, hey, this is how you're not going to be trafficked, because that really places blame on them. Because then if they see, well, I did this, this, and this, it's my fault. We really try to focus on the community as a whole. What are you witnessing? What are you seeing that you can help prevent this from happening in the first place?
Right. And so when you do find someone and you're able to bring them out of that situation, that's not the end of the story. Actually, it's the start of a whole new one where I guess there's a battery of social services that need to be come into play and recovery.
Yes. Yeah, so it depends on the age of the survivor. If it's a minor, it's a whole different story. If it's an adult, then there's different stories. But we have community partners to help us with shelter and different things to help them, because you're right, it's the beginning of the story. It's really not the end whenever they get rescued.
And so what do you do? What happens? What comes to bear?
If minors, CPS comes into play, and they have a very good system to help them to make sure they get the resources that they need and put them in some place where they're going to be safe, that's a limit we have on shelters for adults and minors. It's really hard to find a safe place for them to stay where they're going to feel protected and where no one's going to find them. That's very hard to find.
And Bruce Callison, as you calculate the economic cost of human trafficking, is that what you're looking at also? Is the human services that have to come into play?
That's right. We looked at the variety of costs that go into recovering from a victimization experience, including medical and ER costs, mental health costs, incarceration and criminal justice costs, the fiscal impacts from lost tax revenue when people don't work in a mainstream job, pregnancy and other services. We feel like we came up with a fairly conservative estimate of what it would take over a victim's lifetime in terms of those costs and impacts on the state's economy.
And what was that number? What did y'all come up with?
We came up with an $83,000 figure in current dollars in lifetime costs in today's dollars. So it's a significant drain, $6.6 billion of economic impact on the state's economy, based only on the number of minor and youth sex trafficking victims we estimated in the study. So it's a significant burden on the state's economy that are incurred when this crime is so prevalent.
All right, we're going to continue the conversation into the next hour. Rachel, hang on. We'll get your call when we come back from this break. The phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980. We're talking about human trafficking, modern-day slavery in the state of Texas and here in Bexar County. 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Human trafficking, also known as modern-day slavery. It's the illegal trade of human beings. Human trafficking usually involves a commercial sex exploitation, but it also includes forced labor for agricultural, food services industry, and domestic work. And human trafficking is particularly a major problem in Texas because of our border with Mexico, the number of our high-density urban areas, and also we've got a large volume of international traffic and commerce here. It's estimated that a fourth of all trafficked persons are in Texas, and a third, that's in the United States, and a third of the calls to the National Human Trafficking Hotline are from Texas. So what's being done about this? We're talking about this afternoon. Our phone lines are open. Once you call in, the number is 210-614-8980. And I particularly want to urge you, if this has touched your life, give us a call. Share your story. It'll help us understand how significant this issue is. 210-614-8980. And Rachel is on the line. Rachel, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. Years ago, the HEARTH Act was put into process by Congress, and the HEARTH Act basically says that every year communities must quantify their homeless population. And about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, they added a new component, and that new component was addressing and quantifying the homeless population of unaccompanied children under the age of 18. These were the throwaways, runaways, LGBTQ population, abandoned. And they came to realize, Congress came to realize, and as did other parties of interest, that there was a lack of information regarding where these numbers were. Of course, this vulnerable population goes right in hand with the supply that these sex traffickers use. And what I found from personal experience in working with homeless boards here locally was that we did not do enough to help quantify that. By creating a good census to count these children, we would be able to submit requests for grants for services and housing. Unfortunately, 3 years ago, the data that was submitted to the federal government was that in Bexar County, there were 10 homeless unaccompanied youth. And in the reality of it is that was nowhere near the number, but it was what they were willing to report because they gave all kinds of other barriers in that these children that we had counted did not meet the criteria. So moving forward, I want to get to the point. In these studies that are being submitted to the governor's office, it is hoped that a component to resolve the problem will include a better assessment and census of a population that is vulnerable and is right into the hands of these perpetrators. And I'll take my response off the air.
All right, Rachel, thank you for the call. I appreciate that. Let me throw that over to you, Melissa Torres, Director of Human Trafficking Research at the University of Texas at Austin's Institute on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. It seems like Rachel is saying that there is quite a bit of underreporting going on, particularly with the homeless population. And can you talk about that?
Right. I think a lot of this does go back to, and I want to second what Dina said regarding not being aware of their own victimization. Again, not putting this on the victim, but a lot of the exploitation happens, as I stated earlier, based on vulnerabilities. Obviously, an unaccompanied minor that is homeless has a lot of risk factors and the vulnerabilities that are there for a trafficker that just can come in and take advantage of that, earn their trust, offer them help and services, and then go on to exploit them. Without the victim's understanding of what's actually happening. And so a lot of times what happens is they might present for different issues. You know, they might say, well, I do need this service, so I'm going to go to a certain agency and ask for that, but not be aware of the exploitation that's happening in the background or something else that's happened in their situation that puts them at risk. So if the service provider doesn't know to ask for that or doesn't take the opportunity or doesn't have the tools to screen for it, that can get lost in all the other paperwork and all the other services that are done within the case. The majority of organizations, it's not mandatory to report human trafficking in the state of Texas. Not all service providers or even state employees have mandatory training on trafficking. We don't have a lot of uniform screening tools or even a lot of validated options to actually screen for trafficking. So it's there's a lot of studies out there, and particularly here in Texas, that say that a lot, up to like 1/4 of 25% of victims in going through healthcare or through service agencies or calling into domestic violence or IPV hotlines aren't being identified because it's not one of the main screening tools that we use, and people aren't sure necessarily what to look for. Especially with the homeless population, there's different types of exchanges for survival that occur, and that might not look like trafficking to the victim or to the provider. So a lot more research really does need to be done within that population, but overall we need to do a better job of identifying and screening victims.
Back to the phone lines with Crystal. And Crystal, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing fine. And yourself? Go ahead.
Good. I was listening to, I just got off work. I'm 20 years old. And I was listening to your broadcast. And it's funny because I'm actually a recovering person from human trafficking, originally from San Diego, California. And my mom now actually works with Ransom Life, and it is for human trafficking girls. And I was listening, and I'm like, okay, well, that sounds really interesting that y'all are taking the time to actually, figure it out and see what y'all can do. And I guess what my mom has been doing is with the programmers, so my wife is the girls that come in don't have IDs, they don't have, education because, they've had to stop, so they don't have anything to even start getting a job or even if, they did want to get out of the life, it's difficult to get out of the life because they don't have an ID or they don't have a driver's license or Social Security. So they've been helping, they transport to, education. So they can, it's a way to get out of the life because there's a lot of people that can say, yeah, well, we want them to get better, but we also need the action. And, well, let's take them to school and let's take them to this job interview and let's help them get an outfit for the job interview. Stuff like that. That is what really comes down to it because when you get out of the life, yes, you can get out. But what happens is the girls who go back to their pimps is because it was difficult when they got out. And what the pimps always taught them was, oh, well, you can't do it without me. You'll be nothing, et cetera. So when we get independent by ourselves, independent, like we got a job, we got school, and we start feeling better about ourselves, I think that's what is the key. That's what will definitely help the situation.
So Crystal, can you tell us a little bit about how you got out of the life? How did you break out?
It was domestic violence and pimping all at the same time. I got really tired of it after about 4 years, and it was just very physical. I lost a lot of weight, and I just noticed that, I guess a light bulb came on. I'm not really sure how exactly. My mom helped me get out of San Diego, and now I am in Texas. I got a job, and I'm in school. So. But that's what I've noticed that helps.
Well, Crystal, thank you for calling in with your story, and hopefully there's someone out there listening and you've inspired them to evaluate and get out of the life. Well, let me ask you about that, Dina, the Deputy Director of Programs at San Antonio Rape Crisis Center, Crystal's story and her message. What do you think?
That's exactly what we are able to do with a grant that we just received. We can do just what she said. Help them get back in school, help them get their ID. We can pick them up and take them to those appointments, help them get their life together so they can not be, not want to go back into the life, just like she said. I agree, that is exactly what needs to happen. If there's no long-term aftercare, you're just going to rescue them and leave them where? Okay, just leave them on the street. They need education, food, a place to live, safety and a job so they can take care of themselves. And so I agree with her. That's exactly what's needed, and that's what we're able to do with that grant that we have now.
The getting the ID part, and it sounds frivolous, but it's actually really difficult if you're starting from scratch and you don't have the documents. You can't get a driver's license. You can't get your Social Security card back. There's all sorts of blockages, and it's very and then you can't get a lot of services because you don't have that ID. So it's that's hard.
Yeah, a lot of the services, the requirement is you need a photo ID. So if you've never had a photo ID, that's something we have to do, and that's a very basic first thing, is to work through all that to get that ID, like she said, and then move forward from there. But you're right, you do need an ID to do almost anything.
And the establishment of independent living, take it for granted, get a job, pay your bills, take care of your apartment, keep the lights on. For some folks, that's not easy to do either.
No, and if you've never done it before, if you started, if you were, taken when you were younger, you've never even done these things. You don't even know how to even do them. And so that's where we can help, is to help them find a place to live and a job. You need a job to take care of yourself. That's very important for you to be independent and for you to feel confident that you don't have to go back. You can do this.
Right. And so those are some of the direct services that you provide at
yes.
the San Antonio Rape Crisis Center. And how can people reach out to you there before, what's your number?
Yes, our hotline is 24/7. It's 210-349-7273.
One more time, slower.
210-349-7273.
All right. And we're going to continue the conversation as we talk about human trafficking here in Bexar County, in Texas, across the nation, and around the world. You're invited into the conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Human trafficking happens when one person is controlled through violence, deception, coercion, in situations of commercial sex, forced labor, or domestic servitude. Although human trafficking is known to be prevalent in large states with big urban centers such as Texas, the scope of the crime has been difficult to measure. To address this, a 2014 researchers launched the Statewide Human Trafficking Mapping Project of Texas with the goal of figuring out the prevalence and economic impact of human trafficking across the state. And we're talking about that this afternoon. If you have a question or a comment, the number is 210-614-8980. And Mary has called in. And Mary, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. My daughter is actually a victim or survivor of trafficking. And she was befriended by a man who was a little older than her here in Bexar County, and that's how she was introduced. And when she was actually able to get away, escape, we rushed her to a local emergency room and called San Antonio Police Department, and we received basically no help because she had been drugged during the time, which has been about a month and a half to 2 months. When I called the San Antonio, the sex crimes division, which were the ones that were supposed to handle it, they said, so I hear your daughter's a druggie. And that's basically as far as I got. My daughter had cigarette burns all over her body. It goes on and on. It was horrible.
So, Mary, how's your daughter right now? How is she doing?
She is doing better. She's doing better than that, but she's kind of in limbo. She's still got all of the emotional scars and trauma. She hasn't received any help for that. And she's having a really hard time just getting on her feet.
Have you called the San Antonio Rape Crisis Center?
I haven't. I just heard about that actually on a show a little while ago, and it's something I hadn't thought about.
Okay. Did you get the number? Say the number again, Dina.
I got the number. But I think it's also, it's frustrating as a mother that there are key areas in San Antonio, for instance, like Austin Highway, where police, just different police and local politicians that I spoke to, they know that it's going on. They know it's a huge issue, yet nothing is being done about it. I mean, this has been going on for years, and it just continues to get worse.
And so over at the Rape Crisis Center, they can get your daughter counseling services, and they can figure out what else can be done to help her. Did you ever think this is something that you would have to be confronting?
Never in a million years. Never. We thought my daughter had been abducted. We never. And that's why I've tried to warn my friends that grew up in areas, really nice neighborhoods, kind of in that vicinity, that, this is just a few streets over, and, it could be your son, it could be your daughter, but it's kind of an ugly topic, and people don't want to hear it.
So what's the big message that, the actionable information that people should know in order to deal with this situation?
This is happening miles away from your home, and nothing's going to change until something's done about it.
Did you have contact with your daughter as she was being human trafficked? And did you?
No, we had no contact. I filed a missing persons report with San Antonio Police Department. I had hundreds of, all of my Facebook friends were looking out for her. She was abducted and held against her will for almost 2 months.
Right.
And I never, I never in a million years would have thought this would happen to anyone I know, let alone my daughter.
Mary, thank you so much for your call and helping us process this, and good luck with your daughter. And please call the San Antonio Rape Crisis Center. Dina Franks is sitting right here, nodding yes. So, Mary, thank you for that call. And what kind of direct services can you provide for Mary's daughter?
Definitely counseling for not only Mary's daughter, but for her and any of her family that needs to.
Because this impacts the entire family.
It does. It impacts the entire family. And that's very sad. And I'm very sorry that that was her experience. But I hope that now that she has our phone number, she will call us because we definitely want to help her.
Okay. Another caller with Arnold. And Arnold, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
All right. My question is, I'm from the state of Iowa. I'm an over-the-road truck driver. I come through San Antonio every week. And I'd like to know what us truck drivers can do to keep an eye out for this. I see a lot of prostitution going on at the truck stops around San Antonio. And what can we do?
All right, Arnold.
Not all of us are bad people.
I know that for sure. I know I've met a number of you guys. Many of them are awesome. Thank you. So, Bruce Callison over at IC Squared Institute, anything for Arnold? What can truck drivers or anyone else do that you know?
Great question. Arnold should look up Truckers Against Trafficking, a brand new organization that's working nationwide to connect truckers with an app, phone app, that they can report instances of trafficking to a centralized location for police and other law enforcement agencies to follow up on. Truckers Against Trafficking, they're a fantastic organization working against the very things that Arnold is seeing in his job.
So in the workup to the Super Bowl, I read that airline attendants and other people were being trained to identify trafficking that may be happening in front of them. But yet, Melissa Torres, you mentioned earlier that it's not mandatory that people report human trafficking. So who would you like that to be made mandatory? Who should have to report human trafficking?
Well, that's it's such a convoluted issue. I don't think the answer is necessarily just one response. I really do think it's the community. If we could do it at a policy level for the state, it is mandatory for law enforcement to receive trafficking. CPS at different levels and workers for DFPS, that's also brand new for mandatory training. But it's still not mandatory to report, and we need to remember that. And there's also not a uniform system of training, so we can make sure that everyone is getting the same information and information that's specific to their region as well, because human trafficking, it looks different in every different population, every different region across the world. So local factors need to be taken into place. But what we really need to look at is who really are the first responders. I'm a trained social worker, and we like to think of ourselves as the first responders and the people at the front lines who see possible victims and survivors. And I talked a little bit earlier about us missing a lot of them because we don't have those tools or the training to do so. But the truth is, a lot of us that work in these services have to wait for the victim and survivor to come to us. And the community is at a greater advantage in being there and seeing firsthand a lot of the trafficking situations. Especially when it comes to labor, you know, people go and get their nails done. People go and, you know, purchase different products. People are on the roads and see construction going on. So it's far more possible that on a daily basis we have a hand in labor trafficking and in those supply chains than we do in confronting victims of sex trafficking. I live in Houston, where the Super Bowl just wrapped up this past weekend. And there wasn't a huge influx in sex trafficking the way everyone thinks. There's actually no scientific evidence saying that human trafficking increases around the Super Bowl. But we have seen cases with the World Cup in countries that don't have the infrastructure. And then labor trafficking increases by monumental rates because they're being brought in to create that infrastructure in the stadiums. So worldwide, what are the different things that we can look at and what are the different risks? And that's who we need to work with. We need to train the community on awareness so that we're not victimized ourselves, because no one is safe from this, from being exploited, and ways that we can recognize it. And then we need to train, you know, the first responders on how to screen for this.
We got an email from Marcus. Does San Antonio have any organizations that he could volunteer with to help the victims of human trafficking? He'd like to help. And Dina?
He could definitely call us at the same number I gave, the 349-7273. We would love to have him help us volunteer, but we're also a bigger part of a Alamo Area Coalition Against Trafficking, which is our coalition here in San Antonio. And if he reaches out to us and asks for me, Dina, I can give him that information because we have a ton of organizations that work with us within that coalition.
Well, what kind of things could a volunteer do?
With us, he could volunteer to, it would be general, just all survivors of sexual violence to respond to the hospital when they've been assaulted, to help answer our 24-hour hotline, to go to activities to help spread awareness, help with trainings. There's lots of things he could do.
So, and it's not just women, it's men can do those things too.
Yes.
Because I guess many of the victims or the survivors that you come in contact with are women, right?
Some, not the
but
majority.
You also need men as
yes,
well.
We also see, we also need men and we also see men. So yes, we have male counselors, we have male advocates that answer the phone, that go to the hospital. So yes, the males are definitely a big part of this field.
And Melissa Torres, do you have a hotline number also that people should know about?
The National Human Trafficking Hotline is also a resource center. If you suspect that you can that you've seen trafficking or you need more information, you can call 1-888-3737-888.
So what is the number one thing that a person should look for if they think that they see human trafficking? I mean, what is the telltale sign there, Melissa, real quick?
The three things that they need to look for by definition of human trafficking are force, fraud, or coercion. Is someone being forced, defrauded, or coerced into a situation of exploitation for someone else's profit through commercial sex or labor?
All right, and thank you so much, Melissa Torres, the Director of Human Trafficking Research at the University of Texas at Austin Institute of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Bruce Kellison is the Director of the Bureau of Science Research at the UT Austin's IC Squared Institute. Also with us is Dina Franks, the Deputy Director of Programs at the San Antonio Rape Crisis Center. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you so much for tuning us in.